Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. Today's program is of particular interest to me. I was a foreign correspondent in the Middle East and Africa in the 1980s, and was actually in Lebanon when Hezbollah really came to the fore. And I remember meeting early on with some of the leaders before anyone really knew what Hezbollah was in 1983 and 84 and 85. I'll be your moderator for today's program called From Arab Spring to Islamic State, a Regional Perspective. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. Dr. Banasheh Kanoush is a foreign affairs scholar and media analyst who is a translator for four Iranian presidents. Her latest book is Saudi Arabia and Iran, Friend or Foes. Dr. Dina Ibrahim is Associate Professor of Broadcast and Telecommunication Arts at California State University and is co-producer of the film Hope and Fear, Egypt at the Tipping Point. She is Director of the Entertainment Alliance at CSU and has reported for the BBC, CNN, and UPI in Cairo. Would you please welcome Dr. Dina Ibrahim and Dr. Banasheh Kanoush.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, sharing a panel with Robert Rosenthal and Dr. Dina Ibrahim. The focus of today's discussion is not only the Arab Spring and the Islamic State, but what the region has to say about it. And if you allow me, I'd like to focus on the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran. After all, two countries that are seemingly on the opposite ends of this issue and two powerhouses for now. So what is this all about? Are phenomenon like the Islamic State and the Arab Spring, a question that always comes to my mind, just events, a series of events, or are they developments? With the difference there being that if they are transitory events, then what are the developments to come afterwards? So I'll try to focus on this sort of framework as I carry on with the discussion. When the Arab Spring emerged, Iran was quite pleased about it. The fact that Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, witnessed his downfall just on the eve of the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 gave Tehran all the more reason to celebrate the Arab Spring as a victory of its own. Tehran maintained that the Arab Spring is really modeled after its own revolution, and it kept its fingers crossed that the Arab Spring will also lead to sort of a popular mobilization force, as was the case in Iran some 35 years earlier, that would eventually seal the fate of the region. In Tehran's mind, that fate sealed also the end of U.S. dominance in the Persian Gulf and in the Middle East. It believed that as these popular mobilization forces take over the operations that the United States has conducted with quite a free hand in the region in terms of military or intelligence and so on, will eventually come to an end, and that the Arab Spring will trigger changes in weaker states in the region, probably and preferably in Tehran's mind, in places such as Bahrain, where also the U.S. Fifth Fleet is located. And all Tehran needed to do was to sit back and enjoy what would take place. In Tehran's mind, it would be the only capital of standing in years to come, because after all, Tehran was the first government in the region to stand up to the United States, and the Arab Spring was actually a realization of what Tehran had imagined would eventually happen in the region with anti-Americanism taking over. Well, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia turned to Tehran and said, not so fast. First of all, There's something called the Gulf Cooperation Council, six Arab countries that neighbor Iran. And for good or bad, the Gulf Cooperation Council has come together and united in the face of the Arab Spring. Saudi Arabia actually helped mobilize forces on the request of Manama to protect Bahrain's government. What has been quite interesting is that So Saudi Arabia, in every respect, has also tried to counter Tehran because it also remains an ally of the United States. The same thing kind of happened, the same sort of back and forth happened between Tehran and Riyadh when the Islamic State took over. Tehran said, well, you know, this is your doing, Saudi Arabia, and also the United States, when it invaded Iraq and all the problems that came out, and therefore, you know, these radical forces emerged. And just yesterday, the former vice president of Syria, Khaddam, gave an interview saying that, well, actually, we think, we as Arab nations think that Iran created the Islamic State. And the reason for that being that Iran wanted to use these radical Sunni forces to contain the moderate Sunni forces that are supported by countries like Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, unofficially, I've been following, you know, Saudi statements and discussions and debates in various conferences around the world, has been trying to say when the IS first emerged that it's less of a threat than Tehran is, because after all, Tehran is a Shia state, and it's mobilizing Shias across the region from Iran to Iraq to Syria and Lebanon, creating a Shia crescent, according to the King of Jordan, and also sort of creating a corridor of Shiism that will eventually contain the Sunni Arab states of the Gulf region in particular. When the IS became a big threat in Europe, even in America, given the number of followers that it was able to attract, the Saudis unofficially in these conferences sort of shifted the debate and said, well, it's not so much that the IS is less of a threat than Iran, but if you really think of it, the IS helps buffer the Arab world from the Iranian Shia threat. So in a sense, that enclave of statelet or mini statelet that IS had created across the borders from Iran and Iraq and Syria was sort of seen as a blessing in disguise of some sort. So, you know, what is interesting in this debate that went on between Iran and Saudi Arabia, in my mind, was that both were equating the Arab Spring and the Islamic State with an extension of pre-existing fault lines in the region. The Arab Spring, anyone from the region would have told you even 20 years ago that the Arab world will go through tremendous changes, that it was sudden and trendy, made it very attractive, but there was no way that the Arab world would have remained stagnant for so long. The IS is also, you know, an extension seen in the region as an extension of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. For good or bad, that's how the region sees it. The way they also, Riyadh and Tehran, responded to the Arab Spring was also kind of interesting and revealing in another respect. Essentially, Saudi Arabia, as I said, tried to protect the Gulf Arab states, and Iran went about sort of organizing and staging the departure of its president, Ahmadinejad, who had welcomed the Arab Spring and sort of paving the way for a more inclusive government that is now embodied in the government of Hassan Rouhani. That was done in part also because Saudi Arabia turned to Iran and said, well, how would you like it if this Arab Spring turned into a Persian Spring? And Ahmadinejad, not to be outsmarted by the Saudis, actually said, oh, we do have a Persian Spring. It's under my leadership. I'm the one creating this brand. And even that was too far, right? And Tehran said, well, maybe we need to look at this differently. With regard to the Islamic State, despite the dispute between them, we know that they've also made efforts to destroy the Islamic State. Iran has worked with Baghdad in actually strengthening popular mobilization forces, predominantly led by Iraqi Shias, but also some Sunnis, to contain and indirectly even maybe work with the operations that the United States is leading in Iraq to contain the IS phenomenon. And Saudi Arabia has endorsed the multinational coalition led again by the United States to contain IS in Syria and in Iraq. What's remarkable about these developments is that both Tehran and Riyadh have cautiously navigated this sort of difficult, complex situation in the region in a self-balancing manner. In a sense, they've kept each other at check and tried to really see how to handle this challenge. This is really seen in places like Lebanon, where despite their differences about who the next president of Lebanon is going to be, we see that both Tehran and Riyadh are trying to figure out how to keep the IS problem out of Lebanon. So these are, in a sense, narratives of inclusion, meaning that Riyadh and Tehran want to be inclusive of each other's points of views when it comes to managing situations such as the Arab Spring, events such as the Arab Spring, and the emergence of the IS, despite the disputes between them. But if there is indeed a narrative of inclusion, as I like to see it, then how do we explain the disarray that the region is in? So far, we know that Tehran has refused to go back in line with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in seeing eye to eye with it on how to handle conflicts in Syria, Yemen, Bahrain, etc. Tehran actually celebrates its outreach in those countries. It believes that it enjoys a certain degree of influence that never before, unless when we look at Iran as a Persian empire, did Tehran enjoy, did the capital enjoy in terms of its regional outreach. Saudi Arabia has been more cautious about these Iranian ambitions and tried to really encourage it to come back in line and maybe even, you know, work a little bit with Saudi Arabia. But Iran refuses to do that as long as it sees these events in the region as opportunities to get even with the United States, because ultimately the biggest threat to Tehran's government comes from the United States. And so as long as the United States remains a player in issues such as the Arab Spring, in managing it, in issues such as the IS, in managing it, Iran, even when it works to contain IS or works in some arenas, will still try to get even with the United States. That means it will still try to advance its interests in the region. So in this regard, we witness a narrative of exclusion between Riyadh and Tehran in a manner that leads to the conflict of interest between them and how they extend their outreach to the region. Ultimately, how Saudi Arabia and Iran will respond to these events, to these unfolding events in the region, will seal, in my mind, the final developments that will take place in the region. In my mind, geostrategy still trumps over events such as the Arab Spring and the Islamic State. And so the geostrategic considerations that the regional states will have will define how the Arab state and the Islamic, how the Arab Spring and the Islamic State will shape. If Saudi Arabia and Iran can forget about the trendiness of these events and really focus on the complementarity of their roles rather than the conflicts between them, even though the undercurrents of the Arab Spring and the Islamic State will remain in place and live uncomfortably in the region with the regional states, I think that Saudi Arabia and Iran will be able to manage the fault lines that create these sort of sudden events in the region. If not, we know, Syria is a prime example of it, that things could get expedited into sort of a messianic future for the region, something, again, that, Islamic countries have embraced from the outset. Not that they want to see, you know, the end of the world come to happen very quickly, because that's considered a sin, in fact, at least I know in Shiism, and I'm not familiar with other, religions to this extent, but it's one thing to expedite it as the IS is trying to do. It's one thing to anticipate it. And so, you know, for a government like Iran, the anticipation is important, but certainly they are a they represent a country, and they want to take into account the geostrategic factors in managing the end of, even in managing the end of the world. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that the developments that will shape in the region will sort of have all of these undercurrents that I just tried to explain with it. What trends can we expect given this in the future? First of all, trying to influence events from outside will increasingly be futile, whether it's by the United States or by Russia, and it will only likely exacerbate these pre-existing fault lines. Secondly, there's no doubt that a pronounced messianic trend is inevitable, even in Syria. Again, Syria is seen as the land of 1,000 or 1,100 prophets. It's seen as a land that is to play a role in the end of the world, in the coming of the end of the world. That is a narrative in Islam. The religious nature of conflicts that will continue in the region cannot be ignored. It's undeniable. But what is more important in my mind is how countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran will navigate through it. So far, and in the course of their 100-year relationship, they've used religion to advance foreign policy, but religion, they have tried to keep it in under checks and balances, too, because if not, it can pose a challenge to their own security. Both countries still have a relatively tranquil middle class that will protect them in this transitional phase. The regional subsystem will remain part and parcel of the international system. But if the international system can work with the capacities of the local countries, then countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia will be able to ride the waves of change in the region more smoothly. Essentially, how power will be distributed in the region between countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran will affect how much self-check and self-balancing capacity will emerge in the region to make that ride smoother. In the end, this isn't about Islam. This isn't about Shiism. Saudi Arabia has 2 million Shias plus. The Council of Scholars is reaching out again to the Shias. It's about the difference between Tehran and Riyadh, geostrategically speaking, and I can delve into that in detail later if you want. Ultimately, we're kind of re-entering a pseudo-Cold War era. But this Cold War era had pre-existed also in the region in the 50s and 60s. We hear about the Shia Crescent threat now, but back then there was the threat of the Greater Syria. There was the threat of also fertile land, extending the Sunni world, the Hashemite world. And Saudi Arabia and Iran balanced their interests very effectively, so it behooves them to again strengthen those self-balancing features between them, again, as I said, to ride the waves of change in the region. It's up to them to determine how these phenomena will be a blessing in disguise or reversely precipitate an undignified fall for both of them in areas that are still largely undefined in the region. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kinush. And now we have Dr. Dina Ibrahim.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Dr. Kinush, for your remarks, which I found very, very relevant and very, very important. Iran and Saudi Arabia are key players to the future of the region. So it's critical to get an understanding from that perspective. And thank you, Celia, for the lovely invitation. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be with you. And thank you to each and every one of you who took time out of your busy week and your Friday to fight traffic and various other craziness to be with us today. So thank you. What I will do is, with the short amount of time that we have left, because I absolutely want to make sure we get your questions answered, is I would like to give an overview of the region post-Arab Spring, talk a little bit about from Arab Spring to ISIS, and then narrow down from an overall regional perspective to really talk about the country that I know most about, which is Egypt. I'm working on a film. I've been working on it for 5 years now, over 5 years since the 2011 revolution. So I'm trying to take a longer-term perspective in terms of the post-Arab Spring. The revolution was fascinating. It was riveting. There have been a lot of films made about it. There have been a lot of conferences done on the Arab Spring. It's a very sexy term. But the fact is that 5 years later, we have some really tough realities to face. And the bottom line that I'll begin with is the region is a giant mess. From Syria to Iraq to Yemen to Turkey to Libya, it's a mess. And in most of these countries in the post-Arab Spring, I think that the major lesson that has been learned and we need to continue to learn is that it is much easier to break a system down than it is to build one. And that has been a major challenge moving forward from Arab Spring. And that is why the Islamic State has been so successful in recruiting people, is because there has been very few viable alternatives for a sustainable way forward, right? And that's really what's going on. So I do have a couple of lessons that I will wrap up with. The first one to keep in mind is it's much easier to destroy than it is to build. I have a 3.5-year-old son, and he spends an hour building a Lego structure, and it takes 2 seconds to break that down. And so that's what's happened in the region, is we've tried to move past dictatorship. We've tried to build democracy, and the fact is that it hasn't worked. For the most part, with some notable, very, very notable exceptions, and that is Tunisia. Everybody forgets about Tunisia, but Tunisia is where the movement to change began. It started in Tunisia. It spread across the region to Egypt, to Libya, in North Africa, and to Yemen on the peninsula. So what Tunisia has done with relative success, of course, not complete success because it's not easy, but what they've done is that they have ensured that political Islam has a space for expression in their future. So clearly, there's a movement within political Islam to be part of the government, right? And they're trying. They're trying really hard to be inclusive of political Islam. You know, it's a rocky road, but I would say if we were to look for any hope in the region, we have to look to Tunisia as a really good example of how to best move forward. So the region is a mess, like I said, but it's not completely devoid of hope. Obviously, the situation in Syria is dire, as it is in Iraq. And again, these are examples of regimes in Iraq post-Saddam and in Syria, we hope, at least I personally hope, post-Bashar al-Assad, that building can take place. It's just that nobody's really quite figured out a viable alternative. The Islamic State is not an alternative. And we can bomb it all we want, but we have to figure out what is the strategy to rebuild and how are we going to move forward with an inclusive government. In both Syria and Iraq, you do have a lot of ethnicities, a lot of like breakdown of different religious backgrounds and ethnic backgrounds, and you have the Kurds, and you know, it's complicated. So those are some unique challenges to those countries. In Yemen, which is very closely tied to politics in Saudi Arabia, the same issues need to be addressed, is how is that country going to best, you know, move forward. Closer to Egypt, I would say, is the situation in Turkey right now, where you have, a president who is really trying hard to consolidate his power, a party that is an Islamist party. Turkey was often looked to as a country, a moderate Islamic country, where we could make moderate political Islam work. And that is really coming to question right now with Erdogan and his strategies to essentially eliminate opposition. Anybody who disagrees with him gets arrested, go to jail, and, you know, he's going to move forward with his agenda. And that's really tricky. And when it comes to Egypt, the quick snapshot post-Arab Spring is we had the revolution and the Muslim Brotherhood was elected into power. They were in power for a year when there was another series of mass demonstrations that culminated in 2013 with the army taking over and deposing President Morsi, who was the Muslim Brotherhood elected president. And then and right now we have a former general, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who has been in power about 2 years now. Essentially, in Egypt, what happened is you had the Mubarak regime. Then you had the Mubarak regime obviously had strong ties to the military. It was a stable dictatorship for 30 years. The people said, you know, it's time for a change. And the Mubarak regime had always argued that, look, hey, it's either us or it's chaos. That's your choice, right? You either take dictatorship or stability or chaos. And I think the year of the Muslim Brotherhood sort of proved that point to the Egyptian people. And it's sad, but it's true that in Egypt's case, democracy is just not working out for us. And that the country overwhelmingly voted for el-Sisi, who represented stability and the military, and an ability to avoid the chaos engulfing the region. Do you guys want to be Libya? No, you don't. Would you like to be Yemen? No. Would you like to be Syria? Okay, let's vote for the dictator. And they did. And that is currently the situation in Egypt. There is no freedom of speech there. For 5 years, I've been going back and I've been filming, and I had a permit to do so up until this year. This year, it all had to be under the radar, had to meet in people's homes, and I was nervous. I was worried because I was doing all of my filming illegally, essentially. The journalists can no longer freely operate there. Journalists are routinely arrested. Activists are routinely arrested. Most activists from the revolution are in jail. And they're sharing jail cells with members of the Muslim Brotherhood. So if you oppose the government in any way, shape, or form, even if you do so on social media, they have all that monitored thanks to an agreement with the with an NSA contracted agency. Thanks, America, for teaching us how to monitor social networks in Egypt. And so there's no freedom of speech. The economic situation is very dire in Egypt right now. We have a burgeoning population problem. We're just about to hit just shy of a billion people. So it's the largest population in the region. And it's in trouble. We have no foreign reserves left at all. And so and the Gulf countries are broke, by the way. So Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates and other patrons of the Egyptian military dictatorship don't have the money to just write checks anymore. And that's having a serious impact on Egypt and its stability and its ability to attract foreign direct investment. So job creation has been affected by the Gulf states cutting back. For the first time, we're hearing about Saudi Arabia cutting back on, government subsidies and, you know, losing a lot from their economies as a result of low oil prices. So that's also having a ripple effect into Egypt as well. So Egyptians that had jobs in the Gulf are losing those jobs, or they're getting paid less. And so that's less money remittances coming back into Egypt. So the economy sucks. And it's going to get worse because the only way forward that the government has determined is to get an IMF loan, an International Monetary Fund loan, for $12 billion. Now, the terms of that loan basically mean austerity measures. And so that means that the government has to cut fuel subsidies. So gas is going to be more expensive. Electricity is going to be more expensive. And a lot of cuts need to be made for government jobs. We got to trim, the fat. And we have to make very painful concessions in order to get the foreign currency that we need. So, as an article I recently read, you can look it up. It's called Sisi is a Dead Man Walking. It's pretty much what he is. So, the spirit of the revolution, I believe, in Egypt is not dead. You can throw everybody in jail, which is what he did. But it isn't dead. And when you have people who are starving, it's just going to get worse. The current inflation is 14%. Imagine what it's going to hit after the IMF loan. Oh, sorry, I forgot to mention. We also have to float our currency, which means everything gets more expensive. So right now, the Egyptian pound is like £8 to the dollar. That is about to be £13 to the dollar. So that impacts everything. Everything becomes more expensive to import. Life becomes more expensive. More people starve. So more people are going to be hitting the streets pretty soon to get rid of Sisi. And I think what most Egyptians are going to do is probably go with another military guy. Because, again, we don't want to devolve into this chaos. We do have a serious problem with ISIS in Egypt, and that is mainly contained in the Sinai Peninsula, which is where most militant members of the Islamist movement have concentrated. And so the Sinai Peninsula is precarious. And that is having a serious impact on tourism as well. So you had the Russian plane that blew up, then Russia stopped sending all planes to Egypt. People are scared, you know. I mean, I can't tell you what a gorgeous country Egypt is and how much it has to offer and the history, and I could, you know, go on and tell you how. Anybody been to Egypt? Show of hands? Yes! Okay, so you can back me up. It's a beautiful country, but, you know, tourism revenues, which used to be 40% of our GDP, are practically zero right now. And that's part of the problem, is people are too afraid to go. But I go, and I have a great time every time I go. And I hope that things will get better, despite everything I've said, right? I still remain an optimist. I'm an optimist by nature. And every time I go back, I see hope. I see a lot of fear for the reasons I mentioned, but I do see a lot of hope. I see young entrepreneurs. I meet them every time I go. I've attended a lot of entrepreneurship summits. People basically know that they can't get government jobs. They're not going to rely on government jobs. So young people are actually creating their own jobs. They're starting their own businesses. They're using technology to improve problems that we have, like transportation and the environment. And it's all in the young people. So I think that there's definitely a lot of hope in Egypt. There's a lot of creativity there. Tourism is slowly recovering. There were a lot of European countries that stopped flights to Egypt that have resumed again. The Germans, the Italians are slowly starting to go back. So I think things definitely can improve. A couple of lessons just to keep in mind. Right, I said it's easier to destroy than to build, so we really have to think about what our next steps are. Political Islam can work. And I've always said that the Middle East should look east and not necessarily west. So when you look at countries like Indonesia and Malaysia, you know, Muslim majority countries who are incredibly peaceful, I think that those are the models that we really need to be looking at, right? So political Islam can work if we just kind of, you know, pivot. Europe needs to do a better job of integrating its Muslim immigrants. I mean, this is a serious problem with a lot of ISIS recruits, is Arab kids in Europe who don't fit in and have never fit in, and they've basically been, like, poor and marginalized in Europe, and they just don't care. I mean, you know, screw it. I'm going to die anyway, and I hate it here, and I don't fit in, so I'm just going to go back and be a fighter and fight for God. That's a problem. And it, you know, we really, one of the lessons there is to really look at immigration carefully and to help out young people who don't fit in. We need to accept that democracy in the region is not necessarily a long-term stable solution. I firmly believe that. Like, we tried. It was a cute experiment. But let's really talk about what's going to work for the people of the region. You know, United States' influence in the region is declining. There's no question about it. Russia and China's influence is growing, and their political systems are being looked at as just as valid, right? What's wrong with China? China seems to be doing very well economically, and they don't quite look like a democracy either, do they? So we really have to take a very careful, scrutinized look at our democracy and decide, is that really the solution for the region? You know, and I'll end on this note where El-Sisi, the Egyptian president, was in New York a couple weeks ago, and he met with Trump and Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And of course, he comes home and, you know, he basically declares to the Egyptian people that Donald Trump is the most fantastic man he's ever met. You know, they practically made out when they met, you know, because they just had so much in common, right? And so that's really, you know, what we're looking at in the region. And that should say it all. But I'll leave it there and look forward to your questions. And thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Dina Ibrahim, and I also want to thank Donna Banafshe Kinush, who spoke first. So now it's time for the questions. I'm Robert Rosenthal, today's moderator. We have a lot of questions, and this is such an easy subject to try and answer questions about. And I just want to remind our listening audience that this is a Commonwealth Club program called From Arab Spring to Islamic State. So I don't think in history, there's been such a chaotic period, really, in the Middle East in modern history. World War II, obviously, was quite disruptive but very different because you had forces clearly aligned against each other. You have separate conflicts across the region. And I guess everyone wants to know, is there a solution? But I want to throw a question out to both of you. And really, is there a potential broker here? I mean, now the Russians are deeply involved in Syria, and no one thinks they're going away. They've restored their big, big, big foothold in the region, which they lost with the collapse of the Soviet Union. The United States is clearly involved. You have a moment of chaos here, as you just alluded to, with our presidential campaign. But can you see, this is really so fragmented. Is it a step-by-step, state-by-state solution? Or do the Iranians and Saudis somehow come together and become the key players here that can broker a convening that somehow settles this, and then throw in the collapse of the oil prices, which, as you alluded to, Dr. Ibrahim, have created a whole other set of consequences? So I guess the question is there a potential broker, or is the solution state by state by state?
Please. I don't think there is a broker out there that can fix the problems for the region unless the region does it for itself. Mm-hmm. There never has been I'm not going to delve into history, but because I have to think carefully before I open my mouth about that. But basically at this current stage, you know, especially with the sort of messianic undercurrents that we're all heard of that are happening in places like Syria, etc., the region itself is far more comfortable dealing with that because it grew up with that kind of stuff. I grew up with it. I grew up being told that it's, you know, Mahdi is coming very soon. And I never even questioned it. I'm like, okay, well, I hope I'll be alive to meet him. You know, it's for us, the point that I'm trying to at least make here is that for us, it's more natural to deal with our own problems by ourselves. Because we understand our limits and we understand what we are capable of doing and what we're not capable of doing. And if you look at the history of Saudi Arabia and Iran, despite the numerous fault lines in their relationship, the two countries have never really gone to war with each other yet. They have, and the reason for that is that they self-balance. They fully understand and comprehend what the consequences of that is for each one of them. And if, as outsiders, we can broker a system in the region whereby the regional states themselves take front seat, whereby their capacities are strengthened, then we can hope that the region will do better. At the very least, you know, it's better not to meddle too much. But of course, Russia, the United States have their interests. But they will be very uncomfortable in the fault lines that will exacerbate in the region. They will be at a loss to deal with this whole Islamic narrative in the region, which comes natural to us. And unfortunately, I think that they are a liability for the region.
I completely agree. Completely agree. And would just add that that the negativity, again, I'm an optimist by nature, but when the collapse of the oil prices and the inability of the wealthier states in the region to essentially just throw money at the problem. Without that, I think that there's opportunity for the players to take more responsibility for their problems and to solve them themselves rather than relying on a broker of any kind. And there's also all these external conspiracy theories that, oh, it's never our fault. It's always the fault of, you know, external forces. Oh, it's America's fault. It's Israel's fault. It's somebody else's fault other than us. And so I think that populations really need to take a good hard look at the issues and find out ways to solve them internally without regional or external brokers. And I think it's the same attitude of, you know, if you don't get things handed to you, then you're going to figure out how to create a solution, you know, for yourself. And that's what's happening with a lot of young people and entrepreneurship in the region. Again, I'll point to that as a consistent hope, even in the Gulf states where, you know, there's a lot of money, but without oil money, what are they going to do? And they're finally starting to figure out that entrepreneurship is a very valid way forward.
A question, I guess, for either one of you, but Dr. Ibrahim, why did Tunisia avoid this mess, as you said?
Oh, that's easy. They have a tiny population. So their population is 10 million. They are highly educated. And so their government consistently, in the post-colonial era, they were they're a French colony, and they focused very, very consistently on education. So, small population, highly educated, and I think that they are also the most progressive when it comes to women, and policies of the government that allow women to succeed. They're just very, very progressive in their educational policies, their economic policies. They're not without problems, but I do think that their small population and their proportion of educated people in the population really made a huge difference.
So we're again talking about solutions, but the reality right now on the ground is war in Libya, war in Iraq, war in Yemen, war in Syria. Out of the does there have to be an end to the conflict, the on-the-ground conflict, before the solutions happen? And is it in the interests where you have the alignment of really the Iranian interests and the Saudi interests and where the conflicts are really going on, and now the U.S. and Russia. So does there have to be a military solution before there can be really a diplomatic solution or even a solution that ends the fighting and begins the building of the economies and the changes that you're talking about?
I think your question was so comprehensive that it answered itself, and it's very valid, and you are correct. It's hard to say whether, you know, the military or the political should go first or hand it. Let them go together and do what they can. But in the end, the distribution of power is something that we have not paid enough attention to in our military pursuits, which are absolutely essential to it, to the extent that the mess has to be maybe cleaned up. But the political aspect should go hand in hand with it, recognizing that there are going to be a lot of people on the ground that we dislike, but that is fine. We can find a way of working with them. These people are rational, logical people within the settings that they exist. take the example of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which was an outcast group and still remains one, but at various stages of its history, everyone that pointed fingers at the Taliban was also, you know, determined to talk with them at some level because they recognized the inevitability of negotiations. Saudi Arabia and Iran, in my opinion, are key players in this process. I don't think that they have realized the full capacity that they have in speaking to one another and learning to accommodate their interests evenly across the region, pointing fingers at Iran or at Saudi Arabia. And I'm against both. It is not a helpful thing to do. It's better to engage them. Also, the U.S. can do that. Russia is more familiar with this territory because Russia is closer to the Middle East. Russia in Yemen, Russia in Egypt. The Russians feel it, have a feel for it, that we as Americans don't have that natural feel. So I think all of that has to go hand in hand together.
Yeah, the Russians don't care about human rights. They're just not going to be. But, you know, maybe you guys should consider human rights. And, you know, the Russians and the Chinese don't lecture Arabs on how to live and how to conduct themselves. You know, not to say, of course, that it is a criticism of U.S. foreign policy. And it's just a direct comparison with the ways that the Russians and the Chinese engage in the region, which is just a complete anathema to Americans, to us as Americans, and how we function and the role of the United States in global affairs. It's just a completely different approach.
So is the Russian approach or the Chinese approach more effective then in the Middle East?
Yeah. Sell weapons.
So should we?
And we're not talking to you.
You know, human rights vis-a-vis women or minorities or
no? I don't think that we should. I think if we didn't, and I believe that Trump wouldn't, we would see a different Middle East. We would see a different level of engagement in the region. I think if Donald Trump wins the presidency. And it's not just him, it's really the Republican establishment that is far more pro-military, far more pro-war than their Democratic counterparts, and that we would probably see a change in policy that would facilitate more direct military intervention in the region.
So looking backwards, Obama's now a lame duck. You know, you could argue that the Russian how aggressive they're being is almost a result of that. His statement about crossing the red line after chemical weapons were used and not, you know, attacking may have reduced his credibility in a region that does understand power and force. But looking back for either one of you or both of you, you know, what are the mistakes that the U.S. made that could have ameliorated some of the situation? So whoever the next president is, and I realize you have strong views on Trump, are there lessons to be learned in terms of how to, you know, get to a solution from what the U.S. didn't do or really leverage its strength in the last 3 to 5 years?
Please.
In 2013, I shared a cab ride with a White House official who worked on the Middle East, and he turned to me and said, "Well, what do we do in Syria?" And the atmosphere at the time was such that it was impossible to speak my mind. In hindsight, I had nothing to lose if I had. But I recall that back then, it was nearly impossible not to talk about Syria without pointing the fingers at Iran, as we still do, and rightfully so in many respects. But I think that if we had attempted to engage Iran in a more serious fashion back then over Syria, we wouldn't have some of the problems that we have with Russia today. I really wanted to speak my mind, but I didn't. Plus, I'd like to be paid to speak my mind. being a woman,
absolutely.
And I seldom am paid because of it. But that's a different story. Maybe Mr. Trump or Mrs. Clinton can fix that for us. But I think a lot of things have gone wrong that could have been prevented. Some of them are very politically sensitive issues, the issue of the red line that you spoke of. It's tough to go to war in Syria. We didn't exactly succeed in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and Israel at the time was very concerned about the outfall of conflict in Syria, where the U.S. would be involved, and rightfully so. And, you know, although there was a lot of human rights debates to be made in favor of intervention, I think that we must at all times exhaust the political opportunities that are there on the ground by being accepting of opposite points of view.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right. And in terms of mistakes made, I'm actually going to skip over Obama completely and say that President Bush should have never invaded Iraq. Had he not, the Islamic State would not have the prominence that it does today, and taking advantage of the chaos that ensued post-Saddam.
Well, you could argue, I mean, that the removal of the invasion and the, you know, the elimination of Saddam Hussein, you know, opened Pandora's box or whatever. I mean, Libya, Gaddafi. So is there an argument to be made that the stability or having a more stable Middle East depended on dictatorship? And is that a model that has to work, or can there be some form of evolving democracy?
I think more than democracy, it's best to speak about democratization. Even America is still experimenting with the process of democratization. And I say that with humility, coming from a country that is not democratic, but is also experimenting in its own way and fashion. You know, if you look at Iraq pre-invasion in the region enjoyed a relatively peaceful and stable period for about a decade after the Gulf War in 1991. And in that period, which I've studied carefully, Saudi Arabia and Iran really explored a lot in terms of the mutual capacities that they had to restore some of that balance and when they can do it, so can the rest of the region, because they are powerhouses. So there is an argument to be made, not so much about democracy, democratization, which are important, but about the geostrategic elements that are essential to build peace in the region, and that being the building of balanced relations, the encouragement of balanced ties among all the actors in the region.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think it's a great question. And it's one that causes me a lot of personal grief to have to admit, as someone who protested in Egypt against both the Muslim Brotherhood and President Mubarak, I voted for the socialist guy who 3% of the population voted for, the guy who ran against Sisi, who actually had the courage to run against a man everyone knew would win. I do think it's a process, definitely. But the cold, hard reality is that dictatorship appears to be a reason for fewer lives to be lost and for fewer lives to be ruined and for political and economic stability. And it is with a very heavy heart that I say that, because I am among the millions of people in the region who are hoping for a different outcome.
One of the interesting sides here, and I'd like to hear your comments, is that as you're right, in the 80s, there was the Iran-Iraq war, there was Iraqi Kurdish issues, but regionally it was much quieter. You had Israeli conflict, Israeli and Lebanon, Israeli-Palestinian. Israel is almost a sideshow right now. What are they just watching, or how do you view, does Israel have any role in stabilizing, or are they just gleefully watching the chaos?
My heart goes out to Israel. And I mean that on multiple levels. Israel has helped Iran tremendously, and I hope the Iranians will never forget about that history. Iran has also been good to the Jewish population of the Middle East. I think that Israel understands the region very well, quite well, better than outside actors. Israel also understands its limits as a small country. And I think that Israel would be a country that would appreciate more than anybody else the balancing that could happen in the region. Israel certainly has its concerns with Iran, whether Iran is a bigger problem or the IS, whether IS is a bigger problem than Iran. But if you look at the history of Israel's ties with its Arab neighbors and with Iran, it's always tried to keep its distance from the conflicts that beset the Arab world, from the conflicts that beset Iran, and rightfully so. So I think Israel will be a very, very critical player in the future because this whole messianic narrative links Syria to Israel and to the end of the world. And the Israelis probably are quite aware of that, at least in the religious context. We want, as the United States, to be very careful how we put Israel forward in fighting our wars in the region. Israel will never fall for that. It hasn't so far, and it shouldn't. But if you look at Israel, it also tries to work with Russia. It tries to work with the Arabs. Despite its animosity with Iran, it hasn't attacked Iran yet. I think that we're really mindful of the need to protect Israel. We also don't want to bring Israel into the foray of the disarray because we'll only be feeding into that messianic narrative.
Yeah, I think that Israel, of course, has everything to benefit from stability of the region. And that I know that Egypt and the Egyptian-Israeli relationship is far closer than under Sisi than it was under President Morsi, who was a known sympathizer with Hamas. And so I think that in terms of Israel's stability, it behooves them to support dictators, for lack of a better term. And you know, with Egypt and Israel right now cooperating, particularly in the Sinai Peninsula, there's a lot of security considerations for Israel that the Egyptians can help out with. Of course, some Egyptians, I'd venture to say, most of them are very concerned with the Israeli-Palestinian question as well. And so I think that the more that Israel commits to peace and commits to pursuing a two-state solution, to pursuing a stable and lasting peace with the Palestinians, that will give it the credibility to move forward as a regional partner. So I think that it's in everyone's interest for Israel to stop settlement activity and to really try to move forward to a much more peaceful country. It behooves itself and the entire region when that happens. And I do think that another interesting role that Israel could certainly play in the region's future is in the area of entrepreneurship that I've mentioned before. We've had incredible startups come out of Israel. They have an incredible economy, incredible technology and media and entertainment industries that I think a lot of cooperation could happen in those areas so that everyone is innovating and being creative and cooperating in those fields together. So it really doesn't matter, what religion you are or whether you're liberal or conservative. We all want to innovate and create a better future.
So this conversation could go on for a few days, but it's time for the last question. So here's your opportunity, and maybe I can arrange for you to get paid. But the next president, throw aside your politics. You're invited to the Oval Office as experts on the region. Here's a question for both of you. What do you talk to the next president about in terms of a solution, or what advice would you give them, him or her?
I would tell them to be very careful about how they navigate the conflict in Syria, which we know they will We all know that, but the question is how. And I will insist on a power-sharing structure in places like Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, no matter how much we may dislike the opponent side. I would caution them to work better with Russia. It's one thing to sanction Iran. It's another thing to sanction Russia. Sanction is a tool, but it's not. It doesn't make up for good policy. I would say that America should ultimately be very humble when it navigates through the Middle East.
Completely agree. And I would say don't waste more American taxpayer money on military intervention. Stop killing American people in the region unnecessarily. Work towards solutions that build viable alternatives for the future. Support that. Support the people who are trying to do good things in the region. Support entrepreneurship and creativity. Rather than trying to change political structures, you could give a lot of support to the young people who face a lot of, you know, jobless prospects. You know, teach them to be entrepreneurs. And finally, I would say the billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars in military aid really should be more closely tied to, like, that's a lot of leverage that America has, you know, whether it's the increase in the military package that Israel got or even Egypt getting billions in military aid too. There really hasn't been a point where the military aid has been held to conditions or standards. And I think that America does hold a lot of clout in that area and could be using it a lot more wisely.
Okay. Our thanks to Dr. Banafshe Kinush and Dr. Dina Ibrahim for this really exhilarating, frightening, and deeply challenging conversation today on the subject of From Arab Spring to Islamic State, a Regional Perspective. This has been a meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, and we thank our listening audience and those here today.